This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. As we'll be doing just about every Friday, we're continuing our week in review with a look at politics and government. In just a few minutes, we'll hear from State House reporter Mike Miletich on the most important news this week in Illinois state government and politics. But first, Linda Kenyon is covering Washington politics in our home state congressional delegation for Illinois Public Media. She'll be joining us most Fridays to talk about what's happening in D.C. This week, she had a conflict with our live program, so I spoke with her yesterday afternoon. Linda Kenyon, good to talk with you again.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
The first thing I want to begin talking about is something that has long been pursued by Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, and that's ethics legislation aimed at the U.S. Supreme Court. There was an important step forward in this when the Senate Judiciary Committee, which Durbin chairs, voted on this legislation on Thursday.
The past several months have seen a steady stream of news reports highlighting ethical failures by the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court justices appointed by both Republican and Democratic presidents.
Linda, what else can you tell us about what the Senate is doing here?
Well, the Senate Judiciary Committee did pass a bill to reform ethics in the U.S. Supreme Court. And it was a pretty much a party line vote. It was 11 to 10. The Democrats have the 11 on that committee because they are the majority in the U.S. Senate, so they get the majority on the committee. So it was an 11 to 10 vote in the committee. It's called the Supreme Court Ethics Recusal and Transparency Act, and that's short for CERT. And for you lawyers out there, that is a legal term. So that was no accident that they came up with the name CERT. Anyway, as a result, this will hold Supreme Court justices to the same ethics considerations that a lot of other judges already have to follow, and also members of the House and Senate and their staff people. So it would establish a panel of chief judges from the lower courts. They would investigate and make recommendations if there are complaints about ethics-related issues. And it would also require greater disclosure funding behind any of these amicus briefs that come before the court, the friend of the court briefs, essentially. And it all is spawned from the fact that there have been several instances involving Supreme Court justices that have come up as a bit questionable in terms of ethical considerations.
For example, Justice Clarence Thomas taking vacations sponsored by a billionaire, other justices taking expensive trips without disclosing them. And I guess the Senate Democrats say this is something that other government officials in other branches of government are required to disclose. So why shouldn't the Supreme Court?
Right. In fact, Senator Durbin from Illinois, as you know, who is also one of the top senators on the majority side in the Senate. And he has said, look, you know, I urged Chief Justice John Roberts 11 years ago, he said at the hearing, that that there should be some binding code of conduct. Now, Republicans on the committee said that the Democrats only want this code of conduct because they're upset with the makeup of the conservative court and that they're especially upset over recent rulings, for example, on abortion or the invalidation of President Biden's student loan relief program. And so as a result, they say this is all political. But Durbin says he urged Chief Justice John Roberts 11 years ago, when the composition of the court was not conservative, that it would be a good time to adopt a binding code of conduct, and he did not. He said that basically we can police ourselves. Well, these recent questionable actions by Justice Clarence Thomas, Justice Samuel Alito, and by the way, also some questions about some actions from liberal Justice Sonia Sotomayor, do show that they're not policing themselves, and that if they are involved in certain questionable actions like accepting money or huge gifts from donors, that they need to disclose them, especially if those cases come, if those people who made donations to them or gave them gifts then end up with cases in front of the court. And that has happened on more than one occasion, certainly with Justice Thomas, who has said he did not feel that he needed to recuse himself because he was an impartial jurist and he could rule regardless. So that, of course, upset a lot of people as well.
Well, this is a piece of legislation I'm sure we'll continue to follow because of Senator Durbin's role as chair of the Judiciary Committee. It's also something that's probably not going to advance in general because the House is controlled by Republicans. We're sort of seeing the flip side of that this week as well. The Republicans passed a number of sort of message bills, if you will, as part of the budgeting process, and you're seeing Senate Democrats dispensing with those.
Yeah, these were attached to the National Defense Authorization Act, which is basically a bill that sets defense policy. And it sets a top line for the Defense Department's budget. And this bill that was passed out of the House included a number of amendments that the Senate looked at and said, yeah, we're not going to do that. So they decided instead to take up their own bill. And they have spent the bulk of the week working on that defense bill. And it's not going to have any of those amendments that were attached to the bill, most of them from the House Freedom Caucus, which is the most conservative wing of the House of Representatives. Your Congresswoman Mary Miller from the 15th Congressional District, she is one of the members of that House Freedom Caucus, who was very much behind some of these amendments. Now, what are they about? Well, there's one that is about abortion policy. There's one about transgender healthcare issues. And there's another one about diversity and inclusiveness and programs to that effect at the Pentagon. Those are just some of them. And the Senate again said, you know what? Those don't belong in the defense bill. They are not there because of any budgetary issue. They're just messaging amendments. They're social amendments. And we're not even going to take them up. So what's going to happen? Well, the Senate's bill is a top level of defense funding of $886 billion. It includes a 5.2% pay raise for service members. It includes continued support for Ukraine. And nobody wants to see this bill die. So the Senate's bill is going to have to be reconciled with the House bill. And that's going to be, you know, one of those moments where the conferees, the members of the conference committee, will be sitting around a very long conference table. They'll be ordering a lot of pizzas and they'll be working throughout the night in order to get some kind of a compromise, which is usually a very, very hard thing to do, especially in this day and age, given the makeup of the House and the Senate. And they'll try and come up with one bill that they think both sides can stomach, both sides in terms of Republicans and Democrats, and both sides of the U.S. Capitol building, the House and the Senate. It's a tall order, but it must be done before the defense bill can have final passage. And so while we're talking about this bill now in the House and the Senate and their differences, the final bill is going to look somewhat different.
The deadline for this is late September because the new fiscal year starts in October.
Not only is the deadline for this late September, but they can't do the appropriations bill. See, first they have to do a raft of authorization bills, which is what this is, the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. After that comes the defense appropriations bill. So the bill we're talking about now sets defense policy and a top line budget figure. After that, they can then do the appropriations bill, which means they've agreed on the top line figure. They've agreed on their priorities, their policy, so to speak. And now they're going to take that top line figure and they're going to divvy it up into different accounts or appropriate that money into different accounts that the Pentagon can spend accordingly.
Well, we will wait and be eager to see what happens. Linda Kenyon, thank you as always. Good to talk with you again.
Well, thank you.
And we turn now to state politics. Joining me live is Mike Miletich. He's the Illinois Capitol reporter for WAND-TV, which is in the Springfield, Decatur, and Champaign market. Mike, thanks for joining us. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, Brian. It's great to be talking with you.
So I think the biggest news in state government this week was the Illinois Supreme Court decision upholding the law that will end cash bond here. What happened there?
Well, I absolutely agree with you, Brian. That was the biggest story, and this is months in the making. The Safety Act even going back several years to early 2021. Basically, this was the provision of the law that many people called the pretrial fairness portion. Now, Illinois will be the first state in the country to completely abolish cash bail. This was supposed to happen back on January 1st of this year, but there was a large group of sheriffs and state attorneys that didn't want to have that happen just yet. They wanted to have a little bit more time to plan for this and possibly work with lawmakers and their Republican colleagues to have some changes made to it. Well, this went in court. There were oral arguments earlier this spring, and the decision was partisan, 5-2, with Democrats, of course, and the majority here in Illinois, moving forward with abolishing cash bail. Now, once again, this is a major civil rights victory for many Democrats and advocates. The Republican lawmakers and law enforcement are disappointed with the higher court's decision. Basically, at this point, we're seeing that the justices, including Chief Justice Mary Jane Tice, explained the bail clause of the Illinois Constitution does not include the term monetary. Many people say cash bail. Well, monetary bail is the exact same thing, but monetary is not included in the state constitution, which means cash bail was not necessarily needed, even though many of us know that it's been used in Illinois for many years, going back decades.
And so the bottom line is,
question there.
Yeah, and the bottom line is, in a couple of months, this is going to be going into effect, right? I think the court gave 2 months.
Right, September 18th. So at this point, it basically proved that sheriffs and local law enforcement have to say, okay, let's make sure that our courts, the judges, the state attorneys are preparing for this. Now, most counties were already in that preparation mode before January 1st, and they need to get back in that mode because they have to understand who will be eligible for release come September 18th. And who they should keep there. Another thing to keep in mind is this change will basically add more of a job for the law enforcement and state attorneys prior to a trial, because they're going to have to determine if people can be released, if they're not a threat to the public, and dependent on their type of felony that they have.
Ultimately, a judge makes that call, though, right? There'll be hearings, and a judge will say, yes, this person is too dangerous to release, or this person, you know, they're not dangerous. We can release them as they are, because they're not convicted of crimes yet.
That is correct. And I think a thing that was up for debate many times, specifically leading up to the most recent election, there was a lot of misinformation having to do with if a judge would have discretion in this case. A lot of talking points were, oh, they're just going to let everyone out of jail without thinking about it. But judges will have the opportunity to review each of these cases, as you mentioned, Brian.
All right. So that is certainly the biggest news. And I would just refer listeners, if you want to take an even deeper dive on that, we had an entire segment on it earlier this week. You can find that on our website at 21stshow.org. Mike, you covered another court case, another constitutional law case, but this one was in a trial court in Sangamon County. There were some gun rights advocates who have been challenging the constitutionality of the state's Firearm Owners Identification, or FOID, card. What is that case all about? What happened there?
Well, this case dates back to 2019, and many people in the state have said for years that they feel the FOID card is unconstitutional. They believe that having a form of a license and paying a fee goes against their Second Amendment rights. So Gun Save Life founder John Bach filed this lawsuit against the state, specifically the Attorney General's Office, the Illinois State Police, and Director Brendan Kelly, along with a few other people, including the former state's attorney in McLean County and the former sheriff, because he felt that the FOID card is completely against his rights. There were oral arguments on June 20th that I was there for, and the plaintiffs argued that the FOID Act burdens actions protected under their Second Amendment rights. Their argument, though, went back to the Revolutionary era, basically saying that everyone back in that time had access to guns without having a license or paying a fee. And they felt that if you were to live in that old era, people would look at you as if you were crazy, that you had to pay a fee in order to use your rifle. The other thing that the Illinois Attorney General's office said is, well, of course, people didn't know that there would be this type of need for regulation because they didn't live in this era that we do in the modern day. The judge basically said that the FOID card is constitutional, and paying a $10 fee is not unreasonable for people to have access to this card. Now, this may be a final decision here in Sangamon County, but we know that there are many cases against the FOID card here in Illinois, and it's likely those cases will go to the state level and could end up in the U.S. Supreme Court as well. I do want to mention as well that the Gun Save Life organization does plan to appeal this case because they were frustrated by the outcome.
Yeah, this does seem like ultimately something that maybe it'll take years, but will be heading to the U.S. Supreme Court. Only about 2 minutes left, Mike Miletich of WAND TV, in our conversation today. I do want to ask you, it seemed about a decade ago, it seemed like those of us who were State House reporters, all we talked about was the poor long-term funding status of the state's pension plans. And full disclosure, by virtue of my employment or my home radio station as part of the University of Illinois, I am a member of the state university retirement system. But it's one of those things, if you wait long enough, every news story comes around again. So, Mike, what is this new pension proposal making the rounds this week?
Well, many people know that the pension ramp goes back to the 1995 era, which everyone has thought of as a very backloaded approach to handling the state's debt service. Right now, there is an opportunity that the state could have significant reform. And it's actually a bipartisan idea coming from Stephanie Kifowit and Stephen Reich out of the Illinois House. Basically, their idea is that the Comptroller and Treasurer's Office will transfer $500 million from the state's general revenue fund to a pension unfunded liability reduction fund annually. Now, that would start in around 2030. And this bill would also make changes to the Tier 2 pension plan for people that are hired after 2011. And that could be a big deal because a lot of people are very frustrated with the Tier 2 system. Who's going to end up getting more put into their pension? Obviously, right now, the focus is on Tier 1, but people that are working, let's say, educators, state lawmakers, state employees like yourself, you know, people are concerned about their retirement plans in the future. Mm-hmm. So it's just in the early phases right now, but it does seem that there is bipartisan support for something to happen either during the veto session this fall or at the start of the next session in January.
All right. Well, we will take a deeper dive onto that. 2 minutes is just not enough time for that. Mike Miletich of WAND TV, thank you so much for being with us today on our Friday 21st show.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, we're going to be turning to our Friday Arts and Culture segment, talking with Zachary the Artist out of Springfield. This is the 21st show. Stay with us.